You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Anthony Siss. Anthony, it's good to have you here today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So the way the show starts is with a huge question, and you can take it however you want, but who are you? What do we need to know about your experiences, the values you aspire to live by, the things you've done? What do we need to know to start the conversation?
Yeah. So my name is Anthony Siss, and essentially, I am a queer Latino individual who now lives in Ithaca. Just moved here about a month ago, so fairly new to Ithaca, fairly new to this part of New York. But I've been around and I'm originally from Chicago, lived in Miami, lived in Portugal, lived in Cuba. I studied abroad in Cuba for a short period of time. So kind of a very international person is how I see myself, and really just, you know, curious about different cultures, getting to know the world from many different perspectives.
That's in a nutshell.
Yeah.
That is brief. How did you get launched to be so curious or so engaged?
Yeah. I think definitely my upbringing. So, you know, my parents, my dad, he's originally from Guatemala. So he came to the U.S. when he was 19 years old, and then met my mom in Chicago, who was born in Chicago, raised in Puerto Rico. So just being a part of just those two different cultures, but then going to school in Chicago, growing up in Chicago, and just meeting people from different religious backgrounds, different countries, different parts of the city, let alone. Mm-hmm. So it really just kind of spiked my curiosity to just kind of get to know people from different backgrounds and get to know more about them as an individual.
What part of Chicago did you grow up in?
So I grew up in the northwest side of Chicago. Sure. So very close to the airport, about 10, 15 minutes away from the airport, but in the city.
Right.
And then I went to high school at Lane Tech. So Lane Tech College Prep is where I went to high school with 4,000 students. It was a lot of students. It was right. Kind of a little bit of a culture shock too in many ways, because I went to a private school growing up, and then I went to a public high school.
Sure.
Part of that was mostly due to funding and really just my parents really struggling to find a good high school, and then I got accepted into Lane Tech. So I went there for 4 years, and I loved it.
Sure. Yeah. Cool. And you brought some music with you. What should we open with?
So I really grew up listening to a lot of salsa, really growing up listening to a lot of Latino music. So this song, Rebelión by Joe Arroyo, is really just an all-time classic, and it's one of my favorite salsa songs.
Okay, here we go.
Quiero contarle, mi mano, un pedacito de la historia negra, de la historia nuestra, caballero, y dice así.
No le pegué a la negra.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Anthony Siss. So, Anthony, given the life that you value now, what did you have to learn to know how to live it?
Ooh, that's a really good question.
What are the experiences you've had that have helped you learn how to live it?
Yeah, so I think I've received a lot of advice throughout the course of my lifetime. And I think all of those pieces of advice that I've taken from people who I love and value very much have really helped me kind of get to where I'm at today. One of the biggest pieces of advice that I still carry to this day with me is something that my sister told me many, many years ago. I believe it was my first year in college. And something had happened in college that really shook me to my core, particularly around my identity mm-hmm. as a gay Latino individual. True. And so one of the things that she had told me in that moment was, you can always let something either make you or break you, but ultimately you have the decision for how you get to let that decision impact you, right? And so that's something that I think I've always taken with me is through every particular challenging situation, I've always said, you know, am I going to let this situation make me or am I going to let this situation break me? And so I think that's something that to this day, I think has helped me get to where I'm at today and just helped me view life from a very different perspective in that any particular challenge I can overcome, any particular celebration, you know, mm-hmm. I cherish it in that moment, but then also think about, okay, what can I do to better elevate myself, to enhance myself?
Sure. Before you had that realization, how does your coping now look different than it did before?
My coping back then, I mean, really was coming from a state of panic, I think, right? Particularly as somebody who, before that experience that my sister gave me the advice for, I wasn't out. So, you know, I spent a lot of years in the closet, a lot of years trying to figure out what this being gay thing looked like for me as a Latino male, having grown up in a household that kind of espoused a little bit of machista values and coming from a family that also kind of espoused those same values. And so really, it was really challenging. You know, every little particular instance, I would just kind of have some sort of anxiety breakdown or something like that.
Right. So you were living kind of in a constant state of borderline panic or anxiety, high level anxiety.
Yeah.
Fight or flight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And most of the time it was flight.
Yeah. So how does your life look now in terms of how do you stay with things where you would have either shut down internally or walked away in the past?
Yeah, I definitely read a lot. And a lot of it also has to do with for me to better understand myself and better understand kind of where I'm coming from and kind of understanding myself a little bit better and how I've grown, or areas where I can grow. But then also just keeping in touch with my family, keeping in touch with a lot of close friends who've really also helped me kind of overcome those challenging moments.
Right. So, but the reading is like bringing in others' experience that you can relate to. Is that what I'm? Because when you're reading other people's stuff, it's not your stuff.
Right. So it's a little bit of both. I like to read a little bit of autobiographies from people who maybe I respect and to kind of get a better sense of understanding of how they've gotten to where they're at. So right now, Oprah just came out with a new book. And so I've been reading that book and just kind of it's been helping me understand my own values by reading about how she views her own values, mm-hmm. right? And kind of seeing the success that she's had in her life. But then also most of the books tend to be more so around how do you cope with your particular feelings or how to cope with certain things that are not things that I live by word for word, but I just read it and kind of interpret it for myself.
It can advise your action.
Exactly.
It can inform your response.
Exactly.
What I've, in my own experience, is that if I want to change a visceral response, it's a process of years of coming to understand what the reaction is so that I can have a different reaction from the get-go.
Right.
And that kind of anticipatory not hypervigilance. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. It's being relaxed so that you can do something different.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I've learned over the years is just always being in that constant state of learning and never fearing that I have to know everything all at once, right? Mm-hmm. There are going to be times where I may not know something, even within myself or even within other people, and that's okay, right? So then how do I overcome that obstacle, which is something that my sister, you know, are you going to let this make you or break you if you don't know? And that's something I always repeat in my head,
right? And so how, just walk me through how you ended up from your high school to college and to where you are now.
Yeah. So I was really fortunate and blessed to have this opportunity to go to college. And the reason why I say that is because growing up in Chicago, being a first generation college student, I was the first in my family to get a bachelor's, but I was also, well, not necessarily get a bachelor's, but I was the first in my family to leave the state to go to college. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that was something that nobody in my family had ever done. My original plan was to stay in Chicago, go to the community college. Yep. I had a scholarship to go, and I was going to be content with that, right? What ended up happening was I got a scholarship called the Posse Foundation Scholarship. And so Posse, they award full tuition scholarships to a group of 10 or more students to go to a particular college in a different state. So I was blessed to get that opportunity, and I went to school in Connecticut mm-hmm. for 4 years. And so I had a posse with me, people who I also grew up with, got to know in Chicago, right. And then we all went to Connecticut College together.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And what was the posse experience? I mean, let me fess up a little bit. So part of my own story is that I did dissertation research on some of the most violent, poorest and most violent neighborhoods in Chicago and Detroit and one in New York. And one of the major issues was how to get kids to college in a way that would actually be possible for them to thrive. Right. And so a lot of it had to do, and this was in North Lawndale and West Garfield Park, okay. which are different areas than where you right. grew up. And it's two of the most violent, two of the three most violent neighborhoods in the city. So what they were all calling for was the kind of thing that Posse has since done. My dissertation research was 25 years ago, well before Posse, I think, was around.
Okay.
But that experience helped people to learn. So tell me about the time you spent at Connecticut College.
It was really great. Academically speaking, I think socially it was very challenging. And I think part of the reason why was because I had never grown up around people with so much money and yep. affluence and wealth, which is very new for me. And so learning kind of what the difference between old money versus new money was and seeing how that manifested at Connecticut College was very challenging as somebody coming from Chicago, right?
Sure.
As somebody coming from a working middle-class family, not having that knowing that wealth existed, but not actually fully being exposed to it
right.
until I went to Connecticut College. And so for me, I think the most transformational piece of my 4 years there was being a part of the Posse program and having a really awesome mentor who not only mentored us for our first 2 years, which is the only obligations that a Posse mentor has to the group, but throughout all 4 years, right? Sure. And just getting his support and the support of many other mentors on my particular campus in Connecticut was really, really great.
So I came from rural poverty to Cornell University on a full scholarship. In fact, it was so rich that they paid me to come here in 1976. Wow. But I had never been around that kind of money. And I lived better as a Cornell student than my mm-hmm. mother did back on the farm and working in a nursing home wow. in Missouri. So it was the wonder and the bitterness. But we were alone. And mm-hmm. I had more in common with kids from East New York, the black kids from East New York, or from the kids from the Adirondack isolated rural areas there. But we didn't know how to find each other.
Yeah.
And with the race issues, culture issues, we didn't necessarily know how to connect with each other. And we didn't have a posse. With your posse, what is it that you processed? How did you come to realize, how did you become, for you to take a job at Cornell, you've had to become at least modestly comfortable around affluence.
Yes, definitely.
So how did that happen?
I think for me, it happened with talking about it with some of my mentors who mm-hmm. I met. So I think about one particular experience I'll never forget. My first year in college, I was in a freshman seminar class about the civil rights movement. And in that class, I was the only person of color in that class.
Wow.
And my professor, she was the dean of first year students or freshmen, I think it was called, the dean of like freshman students, something like that. And she was the teacher for the class. So she would always call on students to talk and speak and things like that. And one day she pulled me to the side and I was in her office because mm-hmm. I would go to her office every week because I was very paranoid at the time in my first year around my writing skills. And so I would go to her, ask her for advice. And then one day she asked me, she said, "Anthony, I have a question for you. Why is it that you don't speak in class?" And I said, "Well, do you want to know the real answer? Or do you want to know a different answer?" And she said, "No, I mean, tell me the real answer." And so I told her, I said, "Well, because I'm the only person of color in a class about the civil rights movement, and I don't want to be seen as a spokesperson for all Black, Latino, Asian American, Pacific Islander folks. So I just didn't feel comfortable speaking up." And then after that, she started telling me a little bit about herself, being first generation Italian, coming from, you know, Europe, and then moving here, and then also being the first in her family to go to college, to get a PhD and things like that. And so that kind of, for me, started to break the mold in a sense of how I viewed affluence and how I viewed my role and my particular, how I navigated spaces. Particularly,
so what
there.
Changed for you? What did that change for you?
It just made me realize that I have a place and that I actually belong there.
She broke in and you could break in too.
Exactly. And that was my first semester in my freshman year. And it was such a profound moment and experience that as I navigated the rest of the 3.5 years that I was there, meeting more people who also reaffirmed that for me was just really empowering and amazing. Cool. And helped me get through all of that.
Cool. Did... How did the posse, how was the support most effective among your posse friends?
Yeah.
And did you make friends outside the posse?
Definitely, yeah. The interesting thing was that I was the second posse to arrive on that campus. So
the second year of the program?
Second year of the program. Sure. So it was still fairly new, and a lot of the people, particularly students of color who weren't a part of the posse program, kind of saw us as this exclusive cults or exclusive kind of membership and group.
Wondered what you were all about.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that was really interesting to navigate while we were also still trying to figure out our role and kind of where we fit on campus. So a lot of our support was really informal within the group and just kind of checking in on one another. I think my mentor was really great and strategic in making sure that when we would have one-on-one meetings with him, he would say, oh, have you talked to so-and-so and checked up on them? And because he knew something was going on, but he was being strategic about making sure we connected in that way throughout all 4 years, which was great. And so we would make friends additionally as well. There was this retreat experience called the Posse Plus Retreat. And every year that means that every posse member gets to bring a plus one, which is then considered a Posse Plus member that's not a part of Posse, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of our way.
It's integration in the other direction.
Exactly. So that was kind of our way to get other people into kind of the Posse network and really just also highlight and support the people who've been supportive of us and the work of Posse. And to this day, some of them actually worked for Posse now at some point or are still working for them. So it's been really great.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Let's cut to music. What would you like to play next?
So this next song, it's just a really good feel-good song. It's called Canta Canta Minha Gente. So it's in Portuguese by Martinho da Vila.
Canta, canta, minha gente, deixa a tristeza pra lá. Canta forte, canta alto, que a vida vai melhorar. Que a vida vai melhorar, que a vida vai melhorar.
Que a vida vai melhorar, que a vida vai melhorar.
Cantem o samba de roda, o samba canção e o samba rasgado. Cantem o samba de breque, o samba moderno e o samba quadrado. Cantem ciranda, o frevo, o coco machixe, baião e chachado. Mas não cante essa moça bonita, porque ela está com o marido do lado.
Canta, canta, minha gente, deixa a tristeza pra lá. Canta forte, canta alto, que a vida vai melhorar.
Canta de novo.
Canta, canta, minha gente, deixa a tristeza pra lá. Canta forte, canta alto, que a vida vai melhorar.
Que a vida vai melhorar. Males espanta, lá em cima do morro, sambando no asfalto. Eu canto samba enredo, o sambinha lento e um partido alto. Há muito tempo não ouço o tal do samba sincopado. Só não dá pra cantar mesmo, é vendo o sol nascer quadrado.
Canta, canta, minha gente, deixa a tristeza pra lá.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Anthony Siss. So Anthony, I realize that you're just in your mid-20s. And that's not that... but you have already walked through a lot of different kinds of doors. So what changes would you have not chosen that have been really important for you to make? Mm-hmm. And what changes did you choose that proved different than you thought it would work out? So to put it in a slightly different way, what did you have to adjust to? Like, you know, mm-hmm. you were saying at the beginning, you know, you've got to tackle it, you've got to take it on and see whether it breaks you or not.
Right.
How did you have to change in a way that you really wouldn't have chosen, and how has it worked out for you?
So I think the one experience I can think about is my experience when I was teaching abroad in Portugal, and how I did it coming in with the mentality that it was going to be a phenomenal experience and it was going to be really smooth because I did it through the Fulbright program. Fulbright being a program with other countries, with the U.S. government.
And entered into the American elite.
Exactly. That was actually one of the things that one of my mentors told me when I first got it. It was, he said, welcome to the exclusive Fulbright network, right? And I think that given the fact that I was already going to a four-year college, and then now going into this Fulbright experience really completely changed my mind and shifted my mindset a little bit around just this idea of infiltrating systems and programs that were traditionally not met with people like me and mine.
Right.
And so I think that was super awesome and continuously thinking about that and how I'm also uplifting other people who maybe don't have those same resources. But when I went to Portugal, I went in thinking I'm going to get all the support from the Fulbright network, from the ambassador's office all this stuff. But they ended up, basically, it was just a three-day orientation in Lisbon, and then they put me on a bus and said, okay, you're going to Vila Real, Portugal, 5 hours north of Lisbon, and good luck finding your host person. And I was like, what? Didn't know Portuguese, didn't know exactly who I was communicating with, I didn't have a cell phone in hand, I didn't have access to the internet. So that was such a challenging moment. And I remember that first night that I moved there. Luckily, I found the person who was supposed to pick me up, mm-hmm. took me to my particular apartment. But when I dropped all my bags in the room that I was living in, I just broke down and started crying. Because mm-hmm. I said, how am I going to live here for 10 months? Not knowing Portuguese, not knowing anybody here, not having internet. Couldn't let my family know that I was safe. So I just had this just emotional breakdown. And then once again, am I going to let the situation break me or make me? Mm-hmm. And then fortunately, at 10 months later, I didn't want to leave Portugal.
Right.
I learned Portuguese. I met so many great colleagues who spoke English, but then also spoke Portuguese. They helped me learn Portuguese at a very advanced level. And then my students as well, you know.
And what were you teaching?
So I was teaching English and American culture, quote unquote, whatever that means, right? So,
So
I was teaching American culture and English to business students my first semester. And then my second semester, they increased my load to also include students who were studying theater and then communication studies students.
And these are early college level students?
Right. So this was at a public university in Portugal, which is also very interesting, being 22 years old, being seen as a professor.
Yeah.
And then my colleagues who are older with PhDs were kind of like, what are you doing here? Right. Or what is your specialty?
Right. And I'm you're like, a little American color.
Exactly. I'm a little American boy who had this American accent. And that's also another funny thing I think about is the very first class that I taught. I was speaking English and everyone seemed to understand because most of the people also spoke English, but they kept leaning in. And I was really confused as to why they were leaning in. I'm like, am I saying something that they're not understanding? Then one of my colleagues tells me, it's your accent. Because in Europe, they teach English with like the British English. They're not used to hearing the American accent. So for them, it was a little bit more difficult to understand what I was saying. Not that they didn't, but with the accent. So that was another thing and I also have an accent from Chicago a whole nother layer, right? That people keep telling me. So that was really interesting in navigating all of that. But in the end, ultimately, I really just came out of that experience just so shocked at how much I learned and how shocked at myself I was for having picked up another language, living in another country, not knowing anybody, and how I navigated all of that. And the first 3 months, I will say, were very challenging. They weren't the easiest, but after that, I think it was just such a phenomenal experience.
At the time, was your experience of breaking down and crying in your room when you arrived, was that a point of shame? Or were you able to understand this is just a really hard thing for me to go through?
It wasn't shame. And it wasn't even a full understanding of it was something difficult. Mm-hmm. It was just
a release.
Yeah. Like I just didn't know what I came in with this mentality, mm-hmm. and that mentality of, you know, getting all the support and it was going to be really smooth was just shattered.
You had been cultivated through college, so you didn't have to go through the acid bath of cultural immersion,
right.
from scratch.
Right. And I only had one other experience prior to that where I visited a country and I didn't know the language or didn't really know much, mm-hmm. about the history or things like that. And that was only a visit,
right?
It was when I went to Japan on a class trip.
Sure.
And so for me, that also taught me the importance of body language and how we can communicate so much through body language, even if you don't know the language, which was also really rewarding to know. But this was different because I'm now going to be living in Portugal. I wasn't living in Japan. Right. So I think that for me was just kind of, you know, for me, the question that came up is, how am I going to do this? Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the answer then, but I just had to have faith in myself and knowing that I would somehow figure it out.
Right, right. And if release is the right word for what you experienced in that moment and the struggle that you had for the next 3 months, what were the things that led up to your life? What was the emotional tone of the household or the siblings or the friends that you grew up with that allow you that release?
That's a really good question. Right before that, so kind of the tail end of my senior year of college, I was in a really, really challenging relationship, intimate relationship, mm-hmm. with somebody who I also went to school with. And that experience took a lot on me, particularly at the end of my senior year of college. And there was just a lot of uncertainty around kind of where I was going to go with that particular relationship, where I was going to go in terms of the future. I hadn't found out that I got the Fulbright yet. When I left that particular experience in that relationship is when I found out I got the Fulbright, is when I went to Portugal, and then I went back home for the summer in Chicago and spent a few months there. So I think that leading up to that, that was what was really on my mind. And I think that definitely played a role in kind of the breakdown, emotional breakdown that I had, where not only did I not know where I was, what I was going to do and how I was going to navigate all of this, but I just, in many ways, kind of felt like I was still escaping that, mm-hmm. because it played such a large emotional, psychological, mm-hmm. toll on me, mm-hmm. that it was also a reminder of like the many blessings that I have in terms of my family and my friends who supported me throughout that process, mm-hmm. and that things were going to be okay.
Right, right, yeah. Right, right. And when your heart is given that kind of a workout where it's stretched beyond its capacity, and you figure out where you need to go next, or at least that's the next step you have to take, and the family around you to do it, that's living out loud.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was really great.
Cool.
It was really great.
Yeah. So, I mean, just I'm there's just a quality of, was that relationship that was so intense, was that like your first really intense relationship?
No, it wasn't. Okay. So I kind of, you know, I had a history of previous intense relationships.
So the intensity is what you do.
I try not to do it now, but
I mean yeah. there's as a kindred spirit who did that in my earlier life, and to some extent, I'm very capable of it now, if that's called for.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a turning point for sure. It was one of those relationships that I still think about to this day in terms of how it still impacts me and how I still process it and how I try not to let that kind of carry into current intimate relationships and things like that.
Well, but let the learning carry. But not the patterns.
Exactly, the pattern. So it's something that I'm still processing to this day, that I think in terms of, I guess, previous experiences before that weren't as intense, and I kind of processed it and understood it a little bit more, but that one really was challenging. And it lasted a long time, too. That's another thing. In terms of the duration of it, should have been cut a lot shorter than what it actually was.
How long did it last?
On and off, roughly about 2 years.
Roughly. So it sounds, I mean, that's, yeah. It's... It defined part of your last half of college.
Yeah.
And maybe too much so.
Oh, definitely too much so. But the thing is that, you know, I even then when it happened, I never carried animosity towards the individual. And I think that's something that I've always valued about myself, is that I don't carry like that grudge against certain people. I still wish the best for him. Mm-hmm. I still wish the best for other people when harm gets done to me, mm-hmm. because I'm very a strong believer in kind of energy and karma and things like that. And I don't want to put that energy out there and then get it back
right.
the form of a negative experience.
And this is going to sound like a redundant question, but how did you learn that?
My mom. I think that's something I learned from my mom. You know, my mom, she's had a very forgiving heart, a loving heart. My mom's heart is truly made out of gold. And she's taught me so much about...
And it's made out of gold because it's been refined to that point.
Yes, yes.
Not because it started out as gold.
And it's something that exactly. And I think it's something that she doesn't even recognize herself sometimes, right? And I should probably maybe do a better job of reminding her, even as I'm sitting here thinking about it, but...
Just link her to the show.
Right. but she really does. I mean, she's forgiven so many people who've done her so much harm throughout her life, and she's never carried a grudge, still has carried so much love and respect for those people. And that's something I learned early on, but didn't necessarily have the words to kind of pick up on until I went through some of those experiences myself.
Right. And it's also not carrying a grudge, but it's also the next step, which is establishing a relationship of proper respect and distance.
Right.
And sometimes people cannot carry a grudge, but they also don't know how to hold their own.
Yeah.
And I get a sense that she's doing that, and that's what you aspire to do.
Definitely. Definitely. And it's been challenging for her, and I've seen her in those challenging kind of moments where she's kind of lost herself in that process of forgiving people for the harm that they've caused her, but still, she still stands strong. She still laughs, she still smiles, and genuinely not as a way to kind of cope the pain or things like that.
Not as a release valve, but as a way of restoring oneself to wholeness and not being poisoned by bitterness.
Yeah.
Which is the kind of the negative, the extreme alternative.
Yeah. So that's something I've learned from her, definitely.
Cool. What should we play next?
All right, so I do love Madonna, as many people know, and so one of my favorite albums is Confessions on a Dance Floor. So this song, probably one of my all-time favorite songs by her, is called The Get Together.
Here we go.
Search my whole life, find
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Anthony Siss. So, Anthony, at 26, you seem to be wanting to integrate your personal life and your professional life in a way, and are comfortable in your skin in a way that a lot of people that I have come to know aren't. How do you see yourself maintaining that integration of personal and professional life as you move forward?
I think for me, it's all about authenticity, right? So I think about my professional experiences and I think about my personal experiences and where I've connected the most, where I've grown the most, mm-hmm. both personally and professionally. And it's been with people who've allowed me to authentically be myself. Sometimes I've had to advocate for myself in those spaces in ways that have made me feel uncomfortable at times, right? But the thing is that the authenticity for me is what's really key. And so I just kind of, and for me, I know that's going to grow, right? That's going to change a little bit in terms of how it shows up in different spaces. Right. But that's really, for me, kind of how I continue to merge those two is mm-hmm, by just being authentically myself and being with supervisors and leaders who allow that authenticity to thrive.
Okay, so now I want to kind of frame the challenge in a way that may, you know. So when we have organizational or institutional or family roles, those roles have certain kinds of expectations that we need to honor in order to make the systems that we're part of work. But as a person, our lives are much more complicated and much more whole than any institutional or familial or organizational role will ever have. So there's a tension mm-hmm. regarding authenticity. And for some people, as they go into positions of greater and greater power within organizations, they find it much more difficult to remain integrated with their person because the role commands specific functions. How do you anticipate wrestling with that, or how have you wrestled with that already, given the fact that you've had a few jobs?
Yeah, I think so. So that's the reason why I like to read a lot about people and kind of their success stories, sure. because what you ultimately come to realize is that no successful individual has been successful without having a million and one failures, right? And so from those failures, particularly around integration and things like that, that's the reason why I like to read a lot in terms of people's kind of narratives, their stories, getting to understand how they got to where they were. And in terms of people, particularly in the field that I work in, so within higher education, I aspire to leaders who espouse that authenticity and kind of break the mold a little bit mm-hmm. and kind of ask them that same exact question that you just asked me. Sure. And so just knowing that people like that exists and break the mold. And, you know, in terms of representation, I also think about not just visible representation, but also invisible kind of identity representation. So people who also identify as LGBTQ, but maybe aren't explicitly out about it, but right. are still acknowledge that they're part of the community in some way and have a high leadership role. I look up to people like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just knowing that those people exist for me kind of gives me some sort of kind of aspiration to lead up to, right? To be able to say, if they can do it, why can't I?
Right, right. And it also means being skillful at the more transparent we are with others, the more the people in our world see who we really are. And a lot of our political problems right now are that we haven't really faced each other for decades.
Right.
In my less than humble opinion. But there's also a need for discretion in that sometimes things can be used against us. Mm-hmm. Or things can take a life that we don't really control our lives. We right. are both who we say we are, but we're also who others say we are.
Right.
And learning to navigate that tension. Mm-hmm. How has your coming out, particularly with your family and your community of origin, how has your defining of yourself and their defining of you evolved?
It's evolved a lot, especially with my family. I think with my family, so just a little bit of kind of going back in history too, in context. So I had a uncle who passed away from AIDS-related complications, but he was also gay as well. And so in my family, when I came out, I think there was a large kind of
latent fear about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right, of like, oh my goodness, you're gay. And when something I also came to understand later on is that when he came out as gay, he also came out as HIV positive. And so for my family, it was the kind of one in, you know, it's like a double whammy, right? Yeah, of if you're coming out as gay, that also might mean that you are HIV positive.
Right.
And so that actually led me to do a lot of work around HIV and AIDS education initially in terms of kind of activist work.
Sure.
So when I was in college, I did a lot of work around telling people to get tested, encouraging people to go get tested on college campuses, going to the AIDS conference, the International AIDS Conference in 2012 that was in DC, participated in a ton of protests, almost got arrested by US Marshals. I mean, it was just, and so, and but that ultimately came from that kind of lack of education and awareness from my own family. And
right.
so for me, I felt that I need to educate myself in order to then educate my family, in order to then educate other people.
Yeah.
And so that kind of led to this greater sense of awareness of, for them and also for me, that HIV AIDS is not just a gay issue.
Right.
And that also being gay doesn't necessarily change who I am or what I value, right? Like, I'm still the same child that my parents helped raise and grow up with, values on education, values on making sure that I treat other people with respect and things like that. And so, yeah. Yeah. So I think just that for me, the education for myself and understanding what identity meant for me,
right,
to then educate them has led to this kind of evolution of now that they support me, now they love me, now that they kind of understand a little bit more about how I view my own identity has led them to also change a little bit about how they view others with the same identity. So,
yeah. And that's also using your life, just your daily life as a vocation, as a message without being self-righteous about it. So in 1984, I was visiting persons with HIV AIDS when the nurses would only go in every 2 hours to check them because they were mandated. At that point, we had to get completely gown up, masks, everything, because nobody knew exactly how it was transmitted.
Right.
By 1985, that was all clearer. And we were meeting with people who were female, male prostitutes, gay, straight, everybody, IV drug abusers. It was just a whole panoply of people. But my family, my spouse and immediate family was like, you know, why are you working with these people? Because they didn't trust that would be able to be something that you can just be loyal to people and be reasonably responsible. And this was a time when things were not known.
And what a lot of people don't know too is that in certain areas of the country, and I would even say the world too, you know, it heavily didn't impact gay people, but a lot of the spread of HIV was from intravenous drug users.
Absolutely.
So I did a project my senior year in Connecticut, particularly around New London County, and kind of understanding the people who lived through the crisis and kind of understanding what they saw.
And how they framed it.
And how it was framed versus, you know, what the media was saying. And what all of them said was that the biggest issue in New London County at the time was intravenous drug users.
Yep.
So they were gay, but they were also not gay. They were straight. They were women, people of color.
Right,
but because that media sensitizing of, you know, it's the gay cancer, it's GRID,
right?
And it's, you know, all of these different things specifically related to gay people, that it really not only heavily impacted the gay community in terms of stigma, but it also let a lot of people fall through the cracks in terms of support and resources that they could have used.
Yep. It's good that we're past much of that.
Yeah. So a lot of work to be done, though.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Where are we going next musically?
All right. So Jennifer Lopez, love her as well. And we are going to play Dance Again.
Dance. Yes. Next. Dance. Yes. Shimmy, shimmy, y'all. Shimmy, yam, shimmy, yay. I'm an old dirty dog all day. No way, Jose. You can only go one way. I mean, money. You should check that out. Maybe you ain't turn around. Maybe it's none of my business. But for now, work it out. Let's get this. Darling.
Love to make love to you, baby.
Yeah.
modern day Hugh Hef, yes. Playboy to the death, yes. Is he really worldwide, yes. Mommy, let me open your treasure chest. Play dates, we play mates. I'm the king of snatching queens, checkmate. What you think, it's a rumor. I'm really out of this world, moon, lunar. Make women comfortable, call me bloomer. Can't even show love, cause they'll sue ya. But I tell them hallelujah, have a blessed day. So ahead of myself, every day's yesterday. Want the recipe, it's real simple. A little bit of only, it's your open sesame. Now dreams, yes.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Anthony Siss. So, Anthony, the way we close out the show is with a conversation about how you take care of yourself. And you kind of began the show with learning how to take, with one of the incidents of how you learn to take care of
right.
yourself, which happens sometimes. So when did you realize that one of your primary jobs in life is to take care of yourself? And what do you do to do that emotionally, intellectually, and physically, which for me add up to spiritually?
Yes. So I think for me, my self-care process, however you want to call it, I don't really call it care anymore, because for me, self-care alludes kind of to like a temporary alleviating of what I do to take care of myself. So what I call my personal process is self-preservation. And I give a lot of credit to Audre Lorde, of course, for that, for really talking about self-preservation, particularly for her as a queer Black woman. And for me as a queer Latino individual, I think self-preservation is such a key process, and especially also doing work around diversity and inclusion.
I could appropriate that term as a rural white guy.
Yeah, I mean, in doing the diversity and inclusion work, whether, you know, it be in a social justice space or professionally too, it can take a lot. It can take a lot emotionally, physically, mentally. So for me, in terms of my self-preservation process, I read a lot to make sure I stay educated on myself, my feelings, my emotions, things that validate kind of where I stand on certain things. So one of my favorite books, Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I've read that book twice through and through, and it takes me forever to read, but I'm still always learning something new from it around my own experience, and then how I can also advocate for other people as well and support other people from other marginalized communities, right? And so reading really helps, just talking to my family, talking to my friends. I have a really great relationship with my family now in comparison to when I first came out. And so that's something, you know, in terms of authenticity, I can just know that I can always call them. And in some way, shape, or form, whether it be my sister, my mom, or my dad, it'll, you know, be really affirming.
Something comes back.
Yeah. Something comes back. Same thing with my friends. I watch a lot of TV now. Now that I live here in Ithaca, I have a little bit more time, a little more free time to watch TV, which is good.
So what is it you watch?
So Pose is the new season's coming up in June, but Pose was really it was a fascinating show for me when it first came out.
Because I don't know it, and I doubt that some of my listeners know it.
Yeah, so Pose is a show that's on FX, and so it's about kind of the queer ballroom scene culture in the late 1980s, and it highlights, you know, mostly trans individuals, particularly trans women of color, and it's the first show that also has cast a large number of trans actors ever in any TV show. Also the first show to have an episode directed by a trans woman of color, Janet Mock. She directed one of the episodes, and so for me, that show, watching it, I mean I cried pretty much at every episode. They talked a little bit about HIV and AIDS, the AIDS crisis, now impacted the community, but just seeing representation and seeing how I develop community as a queer person of color being seen on TV and on a major network like FX was just really empowering and just really great. And so I watched that, and I watched a lot of other shows. I've mostly been watching more crime shows. And so there's one on HBO that I just finished watching. It's the case of Ahmed Saeed, I think, or something like that. So it's like a 4-part series, and it talks about just the criminal justice system and how they unjustly, however, you know, arguably they did not provide him justice, and he's still in jail for committing a crime that they convicted him for. But there's a lot of evidence that shows that he didn't do it, but some people believe he did. So, you know, it's kind of left up to the viewer to kind of decide. Sure. But it's a really fascinating piece. So yes, I've been watching a lot of things like that.
Okay, and so I get a strong sense of how you're caring for yourself, intellectually and emotionally. How do you take care of yourself physically?
So I do like to go to the gym. I don't go as often as I'd like to, but for me, the gym isn't about looking good. It's really just a stress reliever for me.
Sure.
So spending that 30, 45 minutes on the elliptical for me just relieves me of all my stress, because I also am a very antsy person. So I can't sit in a long, you know, I can't sit anywhere for a long period of time and not feel like I need to be physically active. And so that's something just growing up, even though I wasn't necessarily very athletic, I just always kind of had issues just... Always in motion, right? And living in a different country, traveling to a different place, you know, my friends always say, can you just sit still at one point, you know, in terms of moving from Miami to Chicago to Cuba to Portugal, just stay still in one place. And so I did that for 2 years, and then I said, I need to go somewhere else. So, so that's when I went to Miami, and then I came here to Ithaca. So yeah, so it's so that's something for me in terms of the physical piece. It's just, I just do it really just to relieve stress and you know, go walk around. And walk a lot. I used to walk a lot in Miami because I used to take the public transit system there. So I used to, you know, just, I just like doing physical things.
Right. And one of the things about Ithaca and is that people, when you used to get their exercise by walking, now so many people use the bus system, but you can walk these hills, you can walk 2 miles, and you know, that's what, 30 minutes if you're reasonably quick, longer if you're not, and shorter if you're really quick.
Right.
But it's a great way to get exercise, but you have to deal with arriving at work very sweaty.
Yes. Yes.
And I don't do that well, but that's so I try to build the exercise into my daily routine, so I don't have to go someplace to exercise. That's where I get kind of frustrated.
I've been experimenting with walking during my lunch breaks too, for 30 minutes, and then the other 30 minutes just go and eat.
Sure.
You know, some people don't have an hour for lunch, but that's something I've experimented.
There was an organization called Cultural Survival that was in a pretty big back in the 80s and 90s. And they used to have, and I'm playing with the word preservation. They used to have a picture of a Native American from the Amazon River Basin in a jar. And the question was preserving culture.
Okay.
And it was just their spoof on, you know, nobody is preserved in that sense. You know, we're constantly changing.
Right.
So how does your preservation program, because I like it. I mean, I like the term, but I'm also a person who'll play with you on all this stuff. how do you use that care to push yourself?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think for me, so I always like debates, not necessarily debates, but I always like to have dialogues with people, right? And about particularly challenging things. And so I think I'm not afraid of it. I think that's where I've done the most growing. And I think that's where many people do most of their growing, is when they're in that uncomfortable space and moment, recognize that discomfort, and then they use something to kind of propel them to move forward from that. So for me, I'm always having challenging conversations, dialogues. One of the things for me that's part of my preservation is that I don't do it via social media. Because then I think that creates a lack of tone in someone else's kind of discussion or dialogue and understanding where they're coming from. So what I always tell people is over the phone or in person, but not over social media. That's just a rule of thumb for me. If people try to start something, I will try to either message them or just say, we'll love to have this conversation further with you, but either in person or over the phone.
Different method.
It's a different, I think for me, it gets lost in translation when there's not that sense of tone, right? When you don't get to hear someone's tone and how they're saying it, which I think plays a huge role in terms of communication.
Right. And if you can be skillful in responding to something and saying, well, if I take it this way or if I take it that way, but that involves so much time.
It does.
And to me, it's a waste.
Yeah. And it could still be interpreted negatively, right?
Absolutely. Especially you didn't get it, you know, or whatever, which is just like.
So I think the dialogue piece is really important, and just making sure that I still have my uncomfortable moments so that I could use that to grow.
Mm-hmm. What propelled you to move from Miami to Ithaca?
So what propelled me? I think for me, Miami was great. I'm a big city person, right?
Sure.
So I loved Miami. It's a very vibrant city. There are a lot of things to do, but it's also very expensive. so you know, in terms of cost of living and also really what I really loved about my Miami experience too is that I got connected to a lot of people who grew up in Miami, who were born and raised in Miami, and they have a very different perspective to Miami than what outsiders and tourists see.
Yep.
And me coming in as an outsider, I had this very, you know, filtered perception of Miami being all about the beach and, you know, people go to the beach all the time. But people who grew up in Miami, that's not their lived experience at all. That's not their perspective at all. And so I was really fortunate to connect with a lot of people who grew up in Miami, who were born and raised there, and taught me so many different things and exposed me to different communities and things that you don't normally see in the media about Miami. And in terms of understanding how poverty looks like in Miami, the gentrification in Miami is just so visible. Right. It's so visible, right? It's, I would say it's at the same level as San Francisco in many ways,
right?
Where you go and there's people on the street and they're right next to downtown San Francisco, right? But people just walk past them and as if it were nothing. Right. And so, yeah.
What you may not have noticed yet is the gentrification is just as extreme here in Ithaca, but it's not as visible.
Interesting.
And I took a leave of absence from Cornell because I was miserable, but I worked construction.
Okay.
So I got to know a lot of locals and a lot of working class folks.
Right.
And so I began to see this, and I've had a 43-year relationship with this community that's been across different classes. And I know exactly what you're talking about. It's a whole different view
to see it. And that's what I've heard thus far too about Ithaca. So I'm curious to kind of, as my time here progresses, to kind of get a better understanding. Because I think for me, it just helps me understand the context of where I'm at and always, it keeps me grounded. Right.
Welcome to Ithaca, Anthony.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So what are we closing with here musically?
So we're closing with Estamos Bien, because at the end of the day, we're all good, by somebody who I'm seeing next week in New York City called Bad Bunny.
Okay. Okay. Anthony, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thanks so much, Eric. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Estamos bien, yeah. Sobre los billetes de 100, yeah. No hay nada mal, estamos bien, está todo bien, ey. Todos los míos están bien, estamos bien, ey. No te preocupes, estamos bien, ey. Sobre los billetes de 100, yeah. No hay nada mal, estamos bien, está todo bien, ey. Todos los míos están bien, estamos bien. El dinero me llueve, a diablo que aguacero, en la cuenta un par de cero, y empezamos desde cero, ey. Y eso que soy un grosero, ey. Que se joda, soy sincero, y si mañana me muero, ya estoy acostumbrado a estar siempre en el cielo, ey. En privado siempre vuelo, en el cuello tengo hielo, gasto, gasto y no me. Sobre los billetes de 100, no hay nada mal, estamos bien, está todo bien, ey. Todos los míos están bien, estamos bien, ey. Hoy me levanté contento y me levanté feliz, aunque dicen por ahí que están hablando de mí, ey. Joda que se joda, que se joda, ey. Ey, joda que se joda, que se joda. Hoy me levanté contento y me levanté feliz, aunque dicen por ahí que están hablando de mí. Ey, joda que se joda, que se joda. Ey, ey, joda que se joda, que se joda. Ey, hoy ando al garata, ey, como un ladrón tirando el birrata, como narco comprando billata, la merced en PR cogiendo boquete. Como soñé a los 17, el que no logra una, ¿por qué no le mata? Dime qué esperas tú, si alguien puede, eres tú. Aunque pa' casa no ha llegado la luz, gracias a Dios porque tengo salud. La vida no tiene repetición, después que mami me echa la bendición, yeah. No te preocupes, estamos bien. Como sin billetes de 100, pero tener no es malo, así que estamos bien, estamos bien, ey. Todos los míos están bien, estamos bien, ey. No te preocupes, estamos bien, yeah. Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.